This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Mexican woman who's not the mother of your children is likely to do a better job than the woman who is emotionally involved and can't be firm and can't, provided you empower her to be to use discipline and to be firm, and you give her a sense of power that she's a surrogate mother while she's there, she will do a better job than you. She can't teach your child Torah. You have to be the teacher. We're not saying that when you get money you hire a teacher. No, you teach. So what do? We change their diapers and cook in the kitchen and we hire teachers. The Torah doesn't say that. The Torah says get somebody else to change the diapers and you teach. That would be far more valuable use of your time, to be doing the teaching and to be doing the chores. And so we bind ourselves down to the chores thinking this is God's will. I am a wonderful Jewish woman. Why am I in a wonderful Jewish wife? And yep, she's a wonderful Jewish wife. What is she a wonderful? She's with the children all day and she's in the kitchen. That's not a wonderful Jewish wife. That's a wonderful Jewish servant who's doing it free. Great. Maybe she'll take my children too. That's not what it means. A wonderful Jewish wife and mother. So today we're talking about the mothering is the raising of the children, the behavior of the children. And that you don't have to be with them all the time to teach them. That you can do. It has to be consistently. It has to be every day. But it doesn't have to be all day every day. That can be and will be better managed very often by the right kind of woman. You can't hire anybody for that. It has to be the right kind of woman. And Mexicans are very good at that. And Africans are very good at that. They have a natural maternal ability. They're kind, good people that empathize with children very, very well, and they're very good child carers, and there's nothing wrong with that. How many times have we seen the Torah, the menekes, the wet nurse that the children had? What is a wet nurse? The only for feeding, the wet nurse was the money for the child. Yaakov had them for his children, and Avraham had them for his children. First thing they did was get wet nurses then. But then they have the wife do that.
Wet nurses had to be eating kosher, right? Because your father said that we absolutely could not have anyone as our children who wasn't. Better to give them a bottle, and even a big deal about it.
Well, because it was a case of really, I would question that. There are cases that yes, people on very, very high levels, and stories about the fact that one of the Mark Antony's converted, and Antonius Aurelius converted to Judaism, and it was traced down to the fact that he had a Jewish wet nurse on the birth of. But these are people on different kinds of levels. We don't have to worry about that too much. But leaving aside the feeding, the breastfeeding, talking about the child caring. So this image that the Jewish mother is meant to be involved in the chores of a Jewish household is not correct. Furthermore, the Gemara requires that every Jewish wife has a job. It's actually in the Shulchan Aruch, it's one of the laws. And warns of the dangers of not having a job. The boredom, the demeaningness, the sense of worthlessness. It's actually required in the halakha that every Jewish woman has a job. The recommended job is a job you can do at home. It's not recommended that she goes out into the business world and meets all the men there. That's not recommended. That's not good for society. The idea is, and it's interesting that we're getting back into an economy now where this is again possible. Until now this was not possible. If a woman wanted a job, she had to go out and work, and very few were fortunate enough to be able to do the kind of work that they can do at home. But today she can go out and work, because she can work at home. And you've got an internet, you can sit in your little house wherever in the world you are, and you can run a major business. So there's no reason for a woman to say, I don't want to work because I don't want to go out of the house. You can be in the house and you can be working. So ideally the kinds of work that in those days the Gemara talks about is weaving and clothes design and the kind of things that one could do from the home and keep an eye on the home. Not a sense that we would abdicate the home at all, but simply to release the woman from the chores of the home so that she can elevate herself to be doing the things that she's good at. Zohar relates to the book of Bereshis and to the creation. And by the way, I've decided for the next Monday night series starting on the 4th of September, we will do the 7 days of creation And thereafter we might select episodes from the Torah. Sunday of creation, maybe the sin, you know, the Akedah, we can do the sacrificing of Isaac, we can select specific things that we can master in a series. And so work our way through a number of different topics. But we'll do the creation and its meaning for us in the 21st century and how the understanding of the creation changes our lives today. And this Zohar deals with an aspect of that, and that was the sun and the moon and their origins. And the Zohar says, "Lo isyashiv sihara legabi shimsha." The moon was not quiet; it was not tranquil in its relationship with the sun. It was embarrassed, but it was belittled by the sun. It felt inadequate in the presence of the sun. It had an embarrassment. It was shy in front of the sun. Siaro Amro, and the moon said, and here the Zohar quotes the verse that we had in Shir HaShirim. The moon said, in the middle of verse 7, "Tell me, my beloved one," he asks, "how can I be expected to graze or to lead my flock?" And the moon says, "How can I take care of my flock, and how can I function at noontime when you, the sun, are so powerful?" The sun answers, "How can a little candle, a little light, show give light at the time of noon when the sun is so powerful?" And then the sun answers, again from our verse in verse 7, "Shalama ehye ka'otia." And the meaning of that explains the Zohar. So God says to the moon, "Kadin as irat garma lemevi reishel atatoi." If you want to have impact on the world below, make yourself smaller. As it says, follow in the footsteps of the flock. God says, "Zili as irat garma, go and make yourself smaller." God says this to the moon. So whereas the Medrash, the famous Medrash, everybody knows the Medrash, it says the two big lights and then it says the small lights. First they were both big, then one was small and one was big, and what happened? And the Medrash, the Gemara brings it, that the moon said that two kings can't reign with one crown. You can't have two people in charge of the same area. There's got to be one superpower, one super being. And God says to the moon, in that case you become the smaller one. That's the well-known Medrash. But the Zohar gives us some background to that. What really was taking place behind the scenes? And what the moon was complaining about was that she was as powerful as the sun, but had no, her rays didn't come to earth. So she felt there was no value in that power. And God says, okay, if the impact on the earth is so important, then that's fine. I'll put you in a position to give impact on the earth, but then you have to become smaller. What does smaller mean? Smaller here clearly means you will then lose the capacity to generate your own light. As we discussed last time, I don't know scientifically how this does or doesn't fit in, whether the moon did originally come of some star that was originally a generator of light but didn't have impact. The stars don't have direct impact, they don't light anything up. They're just pretty to look at out there, although they are enormous sources of light. So it's possible that the moon was part of a star, if one must look at it scientifically or not, but certainly midrashically and kabbalistically, the moon was a heavenly body or belonged to a heavenly body that generated light, but you couldn't see that light on earth. And there must be millions of stars, probably trillions of stars, whose light you can't see on earth. And they're powerful forces of light. The moon objects it. The God brings the moon into the ambit of the earth, gives the moon the ability to function, but in a smaller way. What is the meaning of the smallness? That the Gemara uses less lam the gram of the word midi. It has nothing of its own. Everything that it reflects is the sun. If the sun were to go out, you wouldn't see the moon. And that's in fact what happened at the Rosh Chodesh time. The sun is blocked by the earth, and there's no moon. The moon is only visible when it is reflecting the sun's light. It has no other presence. That's what the Zohar says. Now, what intrigues me is why the Zohar links that story, that midrashic story, to these verses of Shir HaShirim. And if we're saying that Shir HaShirim is a parable of the children of Israel to God and man to woman, then this story must have some meaning for those two relationships. And that's what I want to explore with you today, is what is that meaning? So if we look at it as the children of Israel talking to God, what are the children of Israel saying to God? You've given us a whole lot of power to generate and be creative, but you haven't given us enough impact on the world. And God says, if you want the impact on the world, then reflect my power. Then you've got to be a reflector, not a generator. And that must be where we left. That must be the status of the Jewish people. And how do we understand that in terms of Jewish life and Jewish history? What would have happened if Adam wouldn't have sinned, which was that original intention? If there would have been no sin, would there have been Egypt? There wouldn't have been Egypt. Would there have been Sinai? There wouldn't have been Sinai. So where would the Torah have been? But Adam was never given the Torah. Well, so that now you get the sun and the moon story. So Adam then would have generated his own Torah. He would have created Torah. He would have been so purely aligned with God that his thinking would have matched God's thinking. And he would have generated, as they did in fact in the beginning, before the Torah was given, we're told that Avraham kept all the mitzvahs, that they were eating matzah and Pesach, and even some of the laws that came much later, some of the rabbinic laws that came much later, Avraham was keeping already. Where did he get them from? So at that time, before the giving of the Torah, there was, and certainly with the original intention before the sin of Adam, there was the intention that man could generate. But where would man be? Where would man be operating? The Garden of Eden. He's not going to be in Silicon Valley, and he's not going to be in Wall Street, and he's not. There wouldn't be such things. Man would be in almost Olam Haba. The difference between life and afterlife would be very small. He would be in Gan Eden during his lifetime. Now you talk about Gan Eden as afterlife. He would have been in Gan Eden during his lifetime. That means there would have been some measure of physicality in his existence. The Garden of Eden, it was just a small measure of physicality in his existence. It would have been, instead of 100% spiritual, it would have been 99% spiritual. That was the original intention. So there's not enormous spiritual creativity that would have been the case, but that wouldn't have been translated into changing the world and impacting on the world and making the world. The world would have been a spiritual place where it wouldn't have needed impact. It wouldn't have needed been repaired. It wouldn't have needed, it would just need maintenance. It would just have to have been kept going straight, which is much easier a function. And Adam's objection to that, this is the discussion between the sun and the moon, that when Adam decides to eat from the fruit, what is he saying? I don't want this isolated involvement. I want a world where there's challenge. I want a world where there's conflict. I want a world where there's confrontation. I want the world where there's friction and resistance, as we were talking about yesterday, where there's a need for man to constantly test himself and push himself to the limits. That's what Adam chose. God says, in that case, you've lost the purity, and you can no longer be a generator, because who knows what you'll generate? You'll come and generate all sorts of weird philosophies if you're going to start making up your own philosophies. So if you want to be that engaged in the material world, then come down from your level, and I will need to give you the Torah. And in fact, you'll have to earn the Torah. And then what you will impact in the world is my Torah, not your Torah. Is what? That's the difference. And here in this piece of Zohar, we actually understand the thinking process of Adam and God's response, and what life would have been like before and what life is like after the Torah. And we see what happens to human beings who develop their own philosophies. They are weird and sometimes incredibly destructive and have very little to do with Torah. When you look at any of the philosophies that have been developed, obviously human beings are able to access some of truth. So in every philosophy, whether it's Buddhism or it's the ones that have spun off from the Torah, Christianity and Islam certainly have Torah in them. But the ones that are totally man-made, sure, a human being can reason certain things that are true and good and valuable, but look how well off they are. So God says, once you've decided you want to be engaged in the world, you can no longer be the generator of your own thinking. You can be the interpreter of my thinking. So instead of being the musical composer, you become the performer. You become the interpreter. You take my music and make my music. You want to be a composer, you're not going to have an audience. You want to be a composer, go and lock yourself in a little room and sit with your little piano and compose. And you don't even know whether anybody's ever going to hear that music or not, and it shouldn't be relevant to you. You're making music. If you want to be a performer, if you want to have an audience, then you've got to be a performer. Then you've got to perform Beethoven's music, not your music. They're not interested in yours. They want to hear Beethoven. So if you want to impact, they want to be impacted by God, not by you. So if you will be the conduit, if you will be the interpreter to take God's thinking and make that something that people can understand and relate to, that is your role. But no longer is your role to create religion. Your role is to interpret religion. And that becomes key to an understanding of where the Jewish people are positioned. Now you begin to understand, and let's start with the two movements in Europe. The end of the 19th century, the Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's movement in Germany, and Eastern European Torah. So what is Rabbi Hirsch? Rabbi Hirsch was the beginning of modern orthodoxy. Okay, wanted people to go to college. And that is a concession. He didn't say, well, you know, in order not to lose people, they better go to college. He thought it was part of Torah that you had to have mastery of secular knowledge. You had to be able to take your place in the secular world. You had to know the sciences. You had to know the arts. You had to be fluent in language. That was part of Torah. That was his whole view. Eastern Europe was a Jew's function to sit and learn, and that's it. He doesn't need any of the other stuff. And what's very interesting is there was no conflict between them in terms of their respect for one another's view. In other words, I have no doubt that Rabbi Hirsch, had he gone to Eastern Europe, would never have proposed his style in Eastern Europe. And the Eastern European rabbis never proposed their style for Germany and parts of France that were along that line, Western Europe generally. But they would both bitterly have opposed the application of the other's method in their areas. So if Eastern European Jews, if they did come, started coming to Germany, and Rabbi Hirsch's followers opposed it and tried to integrate them and didn't want them to open up the Chadorim and the Hasidic Shtibels. They didn't want that there. They felt it was not appropriate for that society. And equally, Rabbi Hirsch's followers would not have been tolerated in Eastern Europe. Yet there was no conflict between them. At no time did the rabbis of Eastern Europe criticize Rabbi Hirsch, and at no time did Rabbi Hirsch criticize the rabbis of Eastern Europe. Why not? They're both reflecting genuine Torah. And if you read the works of Rabbi Hirsch, you see what he's reflecting is 100% authentic Torah. He has interpreted it in a way that works for his society, but in no way has he compromised the authenticity of it, and likewise in Eastern Europe. The problem is when that starts developing into a new philosophy that isn't authentic. And then you've got the spin-off of conservatism and of reform and all that. Then, so what is happening there? Now you've got people who are saying, not only do we want to have the impact, but we want to design our own religion. That we haven't got the right to do. That was the moon and the sun. That was the discussion between the moon and the sun with God right at the beginning of creation. That there wasn't that the human race, as it was meant to be, because as the Derech Hashem explains, the intention was not that there would be a separate Jewish people. The intention was that we would all be descendants of Adam. There was no original intention that the nations would spin off into different nations. And God constantly tried to bring everybody back. And he offered them the Torah at Sinai, and there are a number of different cases in history where God gave the world the opportunity to integrate into one religion. So at this stage, before there's an Adam or anything, clearly the intention is that the human, that this is the role of the human race, not just of the Jewish people, is to take God's thinking, God's Torah, to keep it absolutely authentic and to interpret it in the most appropriate way for each community and for each generation. And that was the process that took place. But let's now look at it from the perspective of the man-woman relationship. How would that work? So then we're saying that man and woman were created equal. At one point women, and we're not talking about Eve, we're not talking about Chava, we're talking about the concept of man and the concept of woman, we're talking about the soul of man and the soul of woman, masculinity, femininity. Femininity said, I want more impact. I don't want to play a role where I'm the beauty and I'm the feeling and I'm the emotion, but I'm not interacting, I'm not engaging. God says, no problem, you want to engage, diminish yourself, meaning you can reflect, you cannot generate. Now that becomes a very hard discussion in terms of modern society, and what exactly does that mean? And how do we interpret that in terms of Jewish life? How do we interpret that in terms of modernity and the position and the role of the modern Jewish woman, and not only the Jewish woman? My daughter Fedra asked me while we were on vacation. She said a friend of hers at school said a woman's place is in the kitchen. And is that, she didn't ask me whether that was true, already a child growing up, she said, is that halacha? Is that the way God made women? Or is that just fashion, the way it's developed? Just the way it is. What is that all about? And that's an important question. Of course, I explained to her that women's role is in the kitchen, and that was both halacha and the way women were made. The first thing is I showed her the Shulchan Aruch, which I think I've shown.
She's running, that's worth $100 million,
that
she's dividing the business.
I showed her the Gemara that says that the very first thing that a couple should do, a man should do when he's got a bit of money, is hire servants. And the first thing that the servants made is housekeepers. I think here in America you don't like the word servant, is that right? Does a servant mean like a slave?
Yes.
Has negative connotations.
Like,
yeah, I think we won't use that word. Housekeepers. You hire housekeepers. The Gemara doesn't say housekeepers, the Gemara says servants. but the very first thing that if you've only got enough money for one housekeeper, the first place she goes into is the kitchen. Get the woman out of the kitchen. The next thing she does is, if you've got a bit more money, take care of the children. Absolutely. The next thing, these were not, it's quite clear from the Gemara that this is not the mother's role. This is not what she's meant to be doing, standing in the kitchen and taking care of the children. That's not, it is a feminine role. If you read it, it's better to hire a female housekeeper than a male housekeeper for that role. It's something women are very good at. But that doesn't mean because she's good at it, that's what she's destined for, that's what she's got to do. A man might be very good at clearing the garbage. That doesn't mean that he has to become a garbage cleaner. And if that's his role, and if that's what God created for him, he's got a brain as well. So true, he can do clean the garbage, but he can do other things too. The fact that a woman can cook and is a good child carer does not mean that's what the Torah wants her to be doing. The Torah does not want her to be doing that. The Torah would like somebody else to be doing like that. The Torah would like her to be managing that, but not to be doing that. And there is an obligation, and it's a serious obligation. It's a basis to sue for divorce if a man uses his money for something else other than that. But the first thing is get her out of the kitchen and get the children off her. She doesn't need to be. She doesn't need to be shackled with that. That's right.
Yeah, because who's raising your children?
Yeah. You know what? I'm going to say a horrific thing to you, and you won't like what I'm going to say at all. A good Mexican woman who's not the mother of your children is likely to do a better job than the woman who is emotionally involved and can't be firm and can't, provided you empower her to use discipline and to be firm, and you give her a sense of power that she's a surrogate mother while she's there, she will do a better job than you. She can't teach your child Torah. You have to be the teacher. We're not saying that when you get money you hire a teacher. No, you teach. So what do? We change their diapers and cook in the kitchen, and we hire teachers. The Torah doesn't say that. The Torah says get somebody else to change the diapers and you teach. That would be far more valuable use of your time, to be doing the teaching than to be doing the chores. And so we bind ourselves down to the chores thinking this is God's will. I am a wonderful Jewish woman. Why am I a wonderful Jewish wife? Yep, she's a wonderful Jewish wife. What is she a wonderful? She's with the children all day and she's in the kitchen. That's not a wonderful Jewish wife. That's a wonderful Jewish servant who's doing it free. Great. Maybe she'll take my children too. That's not what it means. A wonderful Jewish wife and mother. So today we're talking about the mothering is the raising of the children, the behavior of the children. And that you don't have to be with them all the time to teach them. That you can do. It has to be consistently. It has to be every day. But it doesn't have to be all day every day. That can be and will be better managed very often by the right kind of woman. You can't hire anybody for that. It has to be the right kind of woman. And Mexicans are very good at that. And Africans are very good at that. They have a natural maternal ability. They're kind, good people that empathize with children very, very well, and they're very good child carers, and there's nothing wrong with that. How many times have we seen the Torah, the menekes, the wet nurse that the children had? What is a wet nurse? The only for feeding, the wet nurse was the money for the child. Yaakov had them for his children, and Avraham had them for his children. First thing they did was get wet nurses then. But then they have the wife do that.
Wet nurses had to be eating kosher, right? Because your father said that we absolutely could not have anyone as our children who wasn't. Better to give them a bottle, and he did a big deal about
it. Well, because it was a case of really, I would question that. There are cases that yes, people on very, very high levels, and stories about the fact that one of the Mark Antony's converted, and Antonius Aurelius converted to Judaism, and it was traced down to the fact that he had a Jewish wet nurse on the birth of. But these are people on different kinds of levels. We don't have to worry about that too much. But leaving aside the feeding, the breastfeeding, talking about the child caring. So this image that the Jewish mother is meant to be involved in the chores of a Jewish household is not correct. Furthermore, the Gemara requires that every Jewish wife has a job. It's actually in the Shulchan Aruch, it's one of the laws. And warns of the dangers of not having a job. The boredom, the demeaningness, the sense of worthlessness. It's actually required in the Halakha that every Jewish woman has a job. The recommended job is a job you can do at home. It's not recommended that she goes out into the business world and meets all the men there. That's not recommended. That's not good for society. The idea is, and it's interesting that we're getting back into an economy now where this is again possible. Until now this was not possible. If a woman wanted a job, she had to go out and work, and very few were fortunate enough to be able to do the kind of work that they can do at home. But today she can go out and work. She can work at home. And you've got an internet, you can sit in your little house wherever in the world you are, and you can run a major business. So there's no reason for a woman to say, I don't want to work because I don't want to go out of the house. You can be in the house and you can be working. Ideally the kinds of work that in those days the Gemara talks about is weaving and clothes design and the kind of things that one could do from the home and keep an eye on the home. Not a sense of you to abdicate the home at all, but simply to release the woman from the chores of the home so that she can elevate herself to be doing the things that she's good at and the things that she's able to do. So the image of the woman in the kitchen, and so that's not so at all. What the Gemara does say, I haven't done the shiur over here yet, have I? That piece of Shulchan Aruch about the woman needing to work and hiring servants. Have I done it with the men as well? With the men as well? In this shiur?
Years ago, in the community was working in infancy, your brother had encouraged us to stay home, not to be the servants in the home, because we had housekeepers early on, but to be there for our children, to take them to all the playgroups, and to be there and to stay home and not to go in the workforce.
Well, I remember him saying that a professional, a woman is a professional. She's a professional mother, takes it seriously as a profession, just like you would take something else as a profession.
No, I disagree with that.
Well, the other added point that it was really the clincher or thing that made it most convincing was, and we had all bought into it, and I think that it worked, that if we did give up our jobs and stayed home, our husbands would make more money, and the home situation would be stronger and more nurturing. And we all gave up. We all had major jobs that we gave up. We went back to later because the children went to school. But we stayed home, and our husbands did make more money. And we were there.
I think it depends very
we
much
the
on
kitchen.
The...
You know, we did have. We weren't washing the floors, but we were at home raising our children, taking them to the park.
I think there are a few things that are important. I think sometimes that is so. I think that we are seeing in this society an enormous cost being paid by both parents being out of the house. And the children being raised almost homeless. I think that is an element, and one has to take care of that. And that's why ideally a kind of a work environment that enables the women to be at home, at least for part of the day that the children are at home, is important. But the other issue is not just the question of being at home a bit. The other issue is what happens to the woman's intellectual development as the man carries on developing. So there's another whole issue that has to come into that. I mean, the man is developing fast, and he's out there, and he's growing, and he's stimulated, and he's developing, and he's meeting people. And she's in the kitchen with 4-year-olds. How long does it take before they're not in sync? So that has to be factored into the whole issue as well. It's not so simple to say the children need you. And what does that claim to help? The children need you now, and when the children are going to need you later on, or need your father later on, the father's going to be off. Or with his head somewhere else, or mother and father have lost the ability to communicate. So we're living in a very dynamic world where things happen very fast, and just as bad things happen fast, good things happen fast, and people grow fast, and people develop fast. And to take a woman out of the workforce and not give her an intellectual substitute for a period of 15 years is a grave danger to the family. You think you're building the family, now the woman's at home, so the family's secure. You're knocking a nail into the coffin of that family. So yes, that the woman should be at home, but then she had better have some other intellectual pursuit, and she'd better be at college, she'd better be studying, she'd better be doing some work from home, she'd better be part of various groups. There's better be something that she's growing from, not involved with 5-year-olds all day. And can on other big families, you can be involved with 5-year-olds for many years. And that's not the requirement either. So one has to look at it with all these things coming into the picture as well. So getting back to that question, was the woman designed and intended to be in the kitchen? No, absolutely not. That's not halakhically required. It's not. That's not what it is at all. But what the woman was designed with, as we see from this piece very clearly, is, and as we've discussed in a number of previous shiurim, is the ability to be supportive. That is the woman's greatest strength. And so everybody's got the willingness to be supportive, and the answer is no. Men, and don't forget, I'm not talking about men and women, because as we've said very often before, every man is a blend of both, and every woman is a blend of both, and it's a question of how much blend. But masculinity is non-supportive. Masculinity is competition. Masculinity is I am the winner, and there are no two winners. And I don't support somebody else to win the game. You don't find a man supporting somebody else. So the best you might find is a team. And we're all in one team, and you might find men able to be in a team, as long as there's not one hero. But you will very seldom find men playing in sport or in real life in a way that makes a single man very successful, unless there are all sorts of other dynamics taking place. Women can do that, and women are designed to be able to do that. And to be able to find somebody they admire enormously, and that should be the most important condition of marriage. Everything else, on whether there's an attraction or not, that's easy. The kid knows that very quickly. But the thing to test in the shidduch, more important than the parents and the grandparents and the yichus and all the rest of it, is do you admire him? Not just respect him. Do you admire him? Do you think he's the greatest man on earth? Because if you don't, there's no way you're going to be supportive. You're going to be supportive of Shlemiel. And that's the role. That's what it's all about. Is because the woman is designed to be able to identify something in a man, and the brilliance that Hashem has put into every woman is every woman identifies brilliance and value in different men. It's not as if everybody wants to be the wife of President Clinton. Fortunately, there are women have it. Each one finds a man that she thinks is wonderful, and something resonates with her, and I think he's great for that. It doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. If you think he's great, and you see greatness in him, and you're willing to dedicate your life to help him develop that greatness as well as your own, but the focus is going to be for him to develop that greatness, then you've got the sun and the moon working. Now, where there's limited money, who stands in the kitchen? If that's the way they're designed. If one has to stand in the kitchen, clearly the woman. If one's going to have to stay at home with the babies, clearly the woman. But ideally, neither of them should need that. There should be different ways of being supportive. So my answer to Chedva was, a woman is not designed to be in the kitchen, but a woman is designed to support a man that she admires enormously. And if that support means being in the kitchen, she'll be in the kitchen. And if that support means raising the kids, she'll raise the kids. And that's where your point comes, Esther, that I'm there to support you, and the support you need at the moment is to know that your household is being taken care of. And I can find the joy and the desire because it's worthwhile. What you're doing is worthwhile for me, and you're a worthwhile person. But there are other issues too that go into that supportiveness. So when man, looking at it from the man-woman point of view, the moon coming around and saying, woman coming and saying, I want impact too, says God, yes, but you can't have a world where there's no supportiveness. So if you want to have impact, if you want to be your own generator, you want to be in the forefront of the creative process, then you need to be in the background in terms of the visibility. If you want to be in the forefront of visibility, you have to be reflective. But that now means the woman's role, just like the Jewish people, does become forefront of visibility, but reflective. So she's reflecting, and whether she's reflecting, again, that's more man and woman, we're talking about masculinity and femininity, whether she's reflecting her husband, or she's reflecting, in today's society, her organization, or her boss, or her MD, or her prime minister, or her president, or whatever it is, that's what she's best at. Taking something brilliant and making it work, taking something clever and making it have impact, is where she excels far more than the creation. And the interesting thing to find is that even in those professions, where numerically the women have always been dominant, very often the creative thinking is disproportionately with men, which is quite interesting. So in cooking, for example, a lot of the really groundbreaking cooking is men chefs. Shouldn't be, because mostly look at the proportions of men and women who are involved in cooking. Surely there should be very few men chefs at the forefront. They are. And design, very often. Fashion design. Who are the big names in men and women's fashion design? A disproportionate number of men. Not that they're male women, but it's disproportionate for the number of women that are involved in the profession. Hairdressing. And all these areas where really it should be women who are at the forefront of the creative push. It's usually not. That making that creative idea work, that wouldn't happen if you didn't have the feminine element, whether it's a feminine element in men or women themselves. But it's that partnership that becomes important in the way God redesigns the relationship between masculinity and femininity. God, the Jewish people, Torah, and the world. And we have this working all the way through. And the issue of feminism to me in the, when was it, the 60s? When did it really start in this country? 60s. Was women saying, we no longer admire the men sufficiently to play a second role. There's nothing to reflect. The lights are out. So we'd better do something about it. And of course the response should have been, both from the men and the women, what do we do to get that light going again? Now we'd better turn, we'd better be the light. How do we get that light on again? That should have been society's response, and wasn't at that time. That gives you some sense as to why the Zohar takes that midrashic interaction between sun and moon and links it into Shir HaShirim, because that becomes critical in understanding the change in relationship between man, God, between man and woman that occurred at the time of the sin of Adam. Are there any questions on that before we close up, because it's important that you don't go away with any misunderstanding. Sorry? You like it? So we're on Fridays now. I think we're okay for a while on Fridays, aren't we?
Let me say, I have some difficulty with the notion that especially very young women, or really just young girls, who are being matched with young men, knowing enough of that person, especially in a dating situation where not only do you have tremendous youth, where it's going to be more physical attraction, is there a spark there, than it is, I really admire what this person has achieved, I want to forward their goal, because how much will an 18, 19, or 20-year-old have achieved today in most instances? A girl of 18 or 19 or 20 is going to know a man well enough to say, this is someone that I would put on a pedestal, as it were. This is someone whose life I want to be.
Absolutely right. But the problem is more, though, the age of the man than the age of the woman. In other words, an 18-year-old girl could quite easily identify in a 29-year-old man who's now, you know, head of an internet company that's successful and has billions in the bank. She can identify that he's somebody worthwhile if that's what she values as being worthwhile. So I think the issue is more than the 21-year-old man who's expecting to find admiration in the eyes of the 18-year-old girl. One of two things happened. Occasionally what happened, maybe not so occasionally, she is able to identify, sometimes with the help of her parents or whoever, the qualities in the guy. So this is the kind of guy, and I've seen his kindness, and I've seen his cleverness, and this is somebody that can grow, and I want to help him grow. And then either that works, or he disappoints her along the line, and then you've got major hassles, and I'll tell you how society is coping with that hassle. Or she isn't able to, and she falls in love with the notion of what he's part of. He's a yeshiva boy from Lakewood, so he must be admirable, because yeshiva boys from Lakewood, it's like, you know, it has a Christian deal, it has the right brand name. So she's in love with the brand. And that's how society has dealt with it. Religious society has replaced the individual with the brand. And so little Beis Yaakov girl, don't worry about him. He's a Lakewood boy. How long can you be? And it's the brand buying which has become part of our life and everything. So she buys into the brand. And even when she chooses the individual and he goes off and doesn't and disappoints her, if she's in within the society, what they try to do is to say, yeah, but he's, you know, the brand, you know, you're part of the brand, and they try and build that up, and it's marketing. Is that what a marriage should be now? And we've seen some of the fallout from that. We're seeing some of the, as long as that illusion stays in place and they're busy relating to the brands, it kind of works. But very often there comes a point where they're looking for something real. And they start seeing real things in other relationships or with other people, and brings into question the quality of that relationship. And we're now beginning to see, and it's the right time, that's what I predicted 20 years ago, now is the time that we would see it, because we're now looking at marriages that were done that well and that are 10, 15 and 20 years old. We're not looking at the marriage in the beginning, that's fine, because you're involved, but the brand is great. But you go out of brand, there comes a point where you don't need a label on your clothes to know that whether they're good or not. You've developed your own discernment, and now using your own discernment, you look at your brand and you say, you know, it's got the brand, but it's made in China. It's not the real thing, and that's causing a great deal of difficulty. Some are confronting it, and some aren't. Thanks, ladies.
Okay.
The behavior of boys and how to put them, how to deal with it, and issues of conduct. Maybe the first meeting should be with the parents without the parents.
No, I don't know. I think have it with the kids. Have it with the kids.
Okay, so can you sort of work around as we will?
They don't live here, they come to share?
Invite them for interest if they would like to. And I just may require, you know, the others are really a requirement to. Yes.